you by Satanic International Network. You're listening to The Ooze.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Clubs. Second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. Third rule of Fight Club, someone yells stop, goes limp, taps out, the fight is over. Fourth rule, only two guys to a fight. Fifth rule, one fight at a time, fellas. Sixth rule, no shirts, no shoes. Seventh rule, fights will go on as long as they have to. And the eighth and final rule, if this is your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight.
That's it.
Right on, man. It's The Ooze. It's the Outbreak Edition. It's Sunday night, and tonight we are going to be talking about Fight Club, and we're going to be talking about specifically the movie Fight Club. We can talk a little bit about the book that came out in 1996. That was written by, and I always hammer this author's name, let's see here, Chuck Palahniuk. I'm sure I'm messing that all up. But I want to stick with the movie because the movie is a little bit different than the book. There's a little bit of alteration going on, and the movie was actually a little bit more received by the public and has had a little bit more of a cultural impact than the book itself. I mean, go figure, we're a visual nation, basically, or a visual society. So, going to be talking about Fight Club tonight, man. Before we get into that, TC, how you doing, man?
I'm awesome, man. I mean, this is one of my favorite films of all time. So when I saw that hit the roster, I was like, fuck yeah. I even went so far as to rewatch it tonight in subtitles, so I would make sure that I understood absolutely everything that was going on again. I didn't want to miss a thing, man. Sometimes being hearing impaired makes a big difference in the information that you take in and the way that you view things. So I went out of my way to find a subtitle file for it and get it all hooked up.
Right on, right on. We ended up popping in our super edition of Fight Club or whatever, and we sat through and watched it, and I was taking notes this time around, kind of writing down different ideas, and this has been it's an appropriate and influential movie, especially when you consider some of the different movements that are going on right now. And I think of, right off the top of my head, would be the Anonymous movement and even the ONA, or what the ONA seems to be trying to morph into based on some recent videos I've seen released. It's relevant. And down the road, I think that this film will actually be considered one of the things that went on to influence our society as it evolved. It was something that had that kind of impact.
I was just going to say, to go on, man, I think even more significant is the amount of actual esoteric understanding that was kind of weaved throughout the entire show, the entire movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so some great shit in there.
Yeah, man, and it's fast-paced. You kind of have to be paying attention or you might miss it. Before I guess we get into that, though, I think we should talk about a couple things we got going on with you since this is what we do. I put a link in the chat room to a YouTube video if you want to check that out. We're having a little auction. I'm auctioning off some of the bric-a-brac that's been laying around my house. Now, this is stuff I wanted to get rid of, and I thought it'd be a good way to kind of offset my costs on the ooze. Not that we won't be paying for the thing out of pocket anyways, but this way there's a way for folks who, if they want to help support what we do here, and want to get a little, you know, knick-knack or whatever in the process. I don't like asking for donations or what have you, and I know there's something we're going to be doing now, which if you want to donate, that's cool, but I always like to try to give people something for, you know, whatever it is they do for us. So that's going on, and I'm sure down the road we'll come up with other things as well. But we'll be taking bids all week long on those things. It's a silent auction. Check out the video. See the little little stuff that I have that I'm giving out and giving away for this, and help support the ooze.
Right on, man. I mean, hopefully people don't pass up on their chance to get that Grim Reaper Beanie Baby, because that really is a rare piece.
Is it?
Believe it or not, prior to my entrance into the fireworks world, I worked in the kingdom of collectibles. More specifically, I dealt with the rare coins and jewelry, the numismatic ends of it more than anything. But during the period in time in which the Beanie Babies were this huge craze, unfortunately, I had my fair share of buying and selling them fucking things. So I can guarantee that that's a rare piece.
Right on, right on. And, of course, the Little Devil starter kit that I'm giving away there is 6 books. I know the video says 7, but 6 books, 2 CDs, and included in that set is the Blanche Martin's The Church of Satan, which depending on, first of all, I guess the thing's out of print. And depending on where you go to look for the thing, you'll see it at anywhere from $20, $25 all the way up to $200 or something ridiculous like that. So if you're into collectible books, that might be a book worth having, and that auction starting at like $50 to kick that thing off. It's weird. I had somebody comment on one of the videos. I placed it all over the place. I had somebody comment on one of the videos, basically saying that if that particular item was remaining after the auction was over, that they'd be willing to pay $50 for that item. And that didn't make any sense to me. So I said, why not? If you're willing to pay $50 for just the one book, why not just place a bid on the auction? So it didn't make sense to me, and I haven't heard back from him. So who knows what was going on with that guy's head? But
right.
Anyways.
Well, here's kind of what I figure. Just go ahead and take that as a bid for $50 on that book, right? And we'll just go ahead and auction the other ones off separately. If that's the case, that's what I would say.
Right, right. Well, yeah, if nobody else bids on it or whatever, if we still have it after the end of the week, then, yeah, I'll get back with them and go, okay, man, where you at? I got the book still or whatever.
Right.
And then we'll, whatever. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to help me clean some of the crap out of my house. like all those books, I don't know what was in my head at one point, but I was collecting. I bought multiple copies of these different books. I think I had it going on where I was actually, putting together sets and then giving away sets to friends or whatever. So that's kind of what I was doing, and I ended up with copies of these books. So just, thinning out my library a little bit.
Right on.
But go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say to kind of real quickly touch on the whole donations thing, because this is something I said I was going to do every show from here on out. They will actually be getting something for their money. They will be getting their voice heard. That's what they'll be getting, because the goal here is to raise enough money to begin to nationally syndicate the ooze, to move the core show. It'll still happen here on BTR, but to move it to also being nationally broadcast, either through XM Radio, Sirius, Clear Channel, or something like that. So,
right on, right on. So, yeah, for your donation, then definitely participate. Call in when we ask you to call in, 347-989-1371, and we'll be asking folks to call in all night long tonight. I know we got a caller on the line right now. It actually looks like, if I'm not mistaken, that's Zach. And
yeah,
I don't know if Zach wants to say something or just if he's just listening in.
He's just listening, and he knows to send me a text message if he wants to talk now. So we're good there, man.
Right on, right on. Okay, yeah, if you want to call in as we're talking about Fight Club tonight, 347-989-1371. And I don't know how long it's going to take to get through the information that, like I said, it's a dense film. Even the film itself is kind of dense with information, with different things going on. So I went ahead and set the show for 2 hours. If we don't do 2 hours, no big deal or whatever, but, it just depends on the level of interest as we move forward. I know a lot of people were talking about this show, catching this show in particular, so hopefully we see some more people in the chat room as the night moves on and get some people calling in.
Right.
So I wanted to start out by kind of pointing out that, first of all, the movie came out in 1999, and it did have some influential, or some cultural impact. There are a lot of copycat people going out there that they were participating in, first of all, forming their own little underground fight clubs, That was one thing that was going on. And then, of course, you had some people doing, you know, kooky stuff. Like I read about a guy who was putting pipe bombs in mailboxes, and his intention was to blow up these mailboxes in the shape of a smiley face, similar to, you know, one of the things they did on Project Mayhem in the movie. He was arrested before he completed it or whatever. The thing that we see going on now with different movements, it's taking the message that's put out there in Fight Club, which is the basic message is that people are products, that the way that our institutions treat us, the way that we are raised and institutionalized and everything else, is that we're a product. The product in the United States is the consumer, okay? That the United States government, the United States institutions, the banks or whatever can guarantee to the world nations out there, all these different people who are producing different things, that they have a market here in the United States, that we have a culture that buys things for status, for lifestyle, for whatever. And the message in the film, a lot of the message in the film, was how just opposed that is to, in many ways, our natural way of being. That kind of culture had to be created, that kind of thing had to be produced. That naturally we aren't necessarily all tied up in status. We aren't all tied up in owning certain products, being a consumer. Now, we can be just perfectly fine without all of the crap that we have. So that's kind of what we'll be talking about. When you look at movements like, again, Anonymous and the ONA, I know Anonymous deals a lot with a lot of social injustices as they see fit, coming from governments or from corporations or what have you. And the ONA is talking about an overall change in our society, a change in our values, a change in the way we do things. But they reflect a lot of things that are mentioned in Fight Club, you know, the independence, the recognition of who you really are. And we'll get into all that as we go on. But anyways, let's see. I also want to talk about how it's interesting, and as somebody who watches films and everything else, you see this often, this model that's used in films. It's called a power trio, basically. And Star Trek is probably the most famous power trio, where you have McCoy, Kirk, and Spock. And they represent three aspects of the mind, according to Freud. You've got Kirk is the ego, the identity of self. McCoy represents the superego, more often than not. He's all the urges of the self, all the desires of the self that, you know, runs willy-nilly and tries to do whatever he wants to do. And then Spock is the id, the logic, kind of, you know, the rational thinking that doesn't take any risks and things like that. We have a power trio set up here in Fight Club. You've got Jack, or the narrator, who's not actually named ever in the film or in the book. He represents the ego. He's the person struggling for identity. He's the guy trying to figure out who he is. Tyler Durden, the antagonist of the story, represents the superego. And in this particular story, the superego has usurped the ego. It's following through with his desires and basically taking over and just doing some kind of manic shit going on. And then Marla Singer, the female, is as close as we could come to an id. She actually lives it, but lives it in a rational fashion. You know, that she's already rationalized the idea that, you know, she's going to die anyway, so none of it matters. I think, as a matter of fact, one of the quotes is that let's see here. She knows she's going to die, or she knows that she could die at any moment. Marla's philosophy is that she might die at any moment. The tragedy is that she doesn't. And this is something that also is inherent in, and I'm going talking for a while on this, it's inherent in Bushido, the philosophical or spiritual lessons of, you know, I guess the samurai in Japan used it or what have you. The idea that these people were told to contemplate death on a daily basis, to, you know, keep in mind, keep all of that in the forefront of your mind, that you could die at any moment. At any moment, you know, this could be the end, and you should be prepared. You should be ready to go to die. With that in mind, with that in the forefront of your mind, all of this other garbage that seems so important, everything else that seems so necessary for you to focus your attention on, gets the volume turned down on it by a huge, you know, amount. So it, you know, encourages you to focus on only that which is truly important, whatever that may be for you, with the knowledge that, you know, you could die at any time. And one of the questions that gets asked in the movie in regards to death is basically, you know, if you, you know, if you were to die right now, what would you wish you had done before before you died, basically? You know, asking, you know, if would you be reflecting upon your life, are you happy with it? Are you satisfied? And that's another major theme in this film.
Right on. Well, I think it's actually posed in a couple of different ways in the movie. I picked up on that question as well. The one I thought was more particularly interesting was who would you fight if you could fight a celebrity? And the one says, I'm trying to remember what the first name was that was given.
The Shatner?
No, Shatner was the one that I'm remembering. I'm trying to remember before that because the other one was Hemingway. That's who it was, Ernest Hemingway.
Right, Hemingway, right.
Yeah, and that's actually like a part two to that question if you really are following the movie along. You know, part one is actually asked. No, actually, now that I think about it, that was the first way that it was asked. And part two was asked as they were in the car and they were talking about what they wanted to do. And the one guy says, you know, build a house. The other guy says something or another. And then he asks Jack, and Jack says, you know, he didn't know. And I actually took a little sound clip, a little 8-second sound clip that happens right after that because I thought that part was very significant and very relative to the question. So I'm going to go ahead and roll that real quick if you don't mind.
Right on.
Hitting bottom isn't a weekend retreat. It's not a goddamn seminar. Stop trying to control everything and just let go.
And that's the whole point. The whole reason Tyler's communicating to Jack here that the whole reason that he doesn't know what he wants to do before he dies is because he's not willing to just let go. He's just not willing to strip himself of this false personality.
Right, right. He's not willing to let go of that consumer identity that has been built into him. You know, and it's hitting bottom is what they refer to it at a couple of times. That, you know, he mentions that, you know, as fucked up as Marla might be, at least she's trying to hit bottom. You know, and it's that awareness, again, that, you know, if you're going to die anyways, it's almost nihilistic, although they're a little more proactive. It's not that nothing matters. It's just that what our focus is on, what our values happen to be. When you put it on the idea that, you know, and they say this a lot too, on a long enough timeline, everybody's survival rate is reduced to zero. Again, keeping that at the forefront of your mind, the things that you think are important, the things that you pursue that you consider important, might not be as important if, you know, if you're going to die tomorrow. That kind of thing was going to happen.
Right. You're not your fucking khakis.
Right, right. And the movie is dense. There's all this stuff throughout the film that talks about this idea that, we all need to, or not we, it encourages me in my mind to seriously take stock and what is it I'm doing? What are my pursuits? What is it that I'm concerned about? And is it really relevant? Is it really, you know, is this, and I say this a lot, is this really part of the monument in time that I'm building to myself? Is this really what this thing that I want there to be there from now on, basically? The way I make my mark for the future. And a lot of the things, it just isn't necessary. And I know having talked to you in the past, you've talked about how you are not, or you try to avoid being that kind of consumer, that you're not somebody that goes out and gets things. You tend to be an experienced type person, that it's more about what it is you're doing rather than what it is you have.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. One of my favorite lines in that movie, and I ultimately think what has developed this thought in my mind, is that the things that you own eventually own you. And I've come to find that that's very true. I talk about this quite frequently. I even made mention of it last night, now that I'm thinking about it. I am not necessarily a philosophical minimalist as much as I am a complete minimalist.
Right on. Right on.
Everything that I own serves function.
And in that theme, in developing that theme of the idea that these material things that we're told to pursue, and this is the thing, we're programmed to do so. We're programmed to want by commercials, by television. We're programmed to desire all this superfluous things and never to be satisfied, never to be happy with what we might have or what we're capable of getting for ourselves. You might be perfectly able to provide for your nutrition completely on your own, completely without having to buy food from anyone else, but it's not what you're told that you should desire. It's not what you're told that you should have or should want. And you know, the line you're just mentioning, you know, that it's things you own eventually own you. What was I going to say? That again, there's just so much stuff here.
Right. Well, I'm myself reflective immediately of a conversation that Tyler and Jack have over coffee, in which you know, Jack's naming off some of the material things that they've at that point both prize, and it's actually over beer. Anyway, they're talking about the things that they at that point prize, and he says to Jack, he says, you know, what does this really mean for us in the hunter-gatherer sense?
Right. Tyler asks the narrator if he knows what a devee is. And the narrator, Jack, goes, it's a comforter. And Tyler goes, yeah, exactly, it's a blanket. He goes, now, why do we know that? Why do two guys know what a devee is? I mean, does it have any meaning to us in a hunter-gatherer sense? And I found what I was looking for. And you see this, again, repeated throughout. The narrator's stuff has been destroyed. Everything that he's been trying to put together that represents him in his life. This is how he expresses himself. This is how he's developed his identity, is through his purchases, through his IKEA catalog, you know, items that he's picked out and filled his apartment with. When all this stuff gets blown up, he keeps repeating this idea that it wasn't just his stuff that was destroyed, it was his identity. It was he himself that was destroyed. He says it to Tyler. He sends it on the phone to a police detective that's investigating the explosion. So it's again, the idea that we're all kind of, we live that way. This is the American consumer. The American everyman is identified by what it is he owns, those status symbols, those things that he has to have in order to feel complete because of the programming we have. And what's the way this message is repeated is in the opposing situation, where the narrator moves into Tyler's house, the Paper Street Soap Company. This place is a dilapidated old building. Nothing works right. After a month, he doesn't miss television, and he kind of enjoys the warm, stale refrigerator, that everything swells, everything moves, everything changes, and it's always falling apart. But it's shelter, and it's all they really need. They don't need anything else. They don't need anything more fancy or anything like that. That they have shelter, and it's in what they do that they find satisfaction. They begin to develop or build identities based on what it is, what their pursuits are, rather than the things they're pursuing.
Right. I mean, I think there's like a lot of great stuff going on in the film in terms of that kind of thing. It really make you stop and think about what little significances things have. Because here we're talking about that materialistic avenue, and in the beginning of the movie, one of the first things that we're made aware of, and the narrator actually goes through the trouble of rewinding extra 6 months to build this backstory about his, you know, lack of ability to sleep and his feeling of disconnection and his just lack of empathy, and it's a attempt to patch this. He actually goes through this process of going to these near-death group meetings and crying with these people.
Right, and it's again relating to this theme that this sort of consumer product that we've become in our society, it creates a kind of neurosis that we stop functioning as we would naturally, and we have this weird. I've heard it described in other ways by different philosophers as we've got a hole within us that no matter what we have, we can't fill. And that hole has been created. That hole has been programmed into us by society. So Jack, the narrator, he goes to these other places where these people are dying. These people are facing death. And he experiences bliss in the presence of these people because, at least he has his life. And he's able to sleep. And the insomnia is, again, just a part of the neurosis, I think. It's a more extreme expression of it. But the same neurotic behavior that, especially when you talk to people from other cultures, people from other countries, who look at people and how we function in the United States, and it's a cultural shock for a lot of these folks who just don't get why we do the things we do. They consider, a lot of our behaviors neurotic.
Right. Do you mind if I make just a minor correction in that?
Sure, go ahead.
He only gets the sense when he's visiting these things and doing this, that he's actually able to sleep. If anybody's really paying attention to the storyline, he had been renting that house for well over a year and setting up all of these things for well over a year before his alter ego even introduced itself to him.
Right, right. Well, yeah, he thought he was sleeping and sleeping well, but in fact, he was doing his Tyler thing and he'd been doing it for a while.
So
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But again, it points back to this neurosis. And the author, and if you've read some of his other books, it seems to be a singular theme throughout his books is the idea that there's some neurosis or some imbalance in one of the main characters in the book, and that imbalance becomes the linchpin for the whole story. In this case, it's insomnia, and insomnia brought on by this, consumer drone lifestyle that he finds himself placed into that is not natural, at least for him. And when we talk about, when you watch the news, when you hear the talking heads talk about our society, where our culture is going and everything, it's repeated. The idea that the kind of things that we do, it's neurotic, that it isn't natural. But it's our way of life here in the United States.
Go ahead, man.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it speaks on a level to me that makes me really wonder, how forced what we consider natural human behavior is. I think this is one of the reasons why I think there's a kind of a fourth way theme floating behind the movie Fight Club as well, because there's just like this overdeveloped personality, and the essence is just suffocated by it.
Right, right. And the idea that is expressed by Fight Club is not a new idea, and it's not an idea that's been singularly explored by any particular philosophy. And you're absolutely right; it's there in the fourth way, where the fourth way says you need to question who you are. What's interesting is that the author points out that a near-death experience, a fight for your survival, is probably one of the quickest routes in figuring out who you are. One of the fastest ways to figure out, what's really important to you when your life is about to be taken away or your life is threatened. Suddenly, again, all the superfluous things that we consider important in our day-to-day lives get the volume turned down on it real quick because we're talking about your life and your health and everything else being actually threatened. So when we talk about, especially if we put it in as far as the fourth way discussion, the fourth way talks about long period of introspection, this long path towards toward building towards getting an idea of who you are and what you're about. I find it interesting that in this movie they present a very it's an ugly shortcut. But it's a very, it makes sense in my mind, this shortcut. That all you have to do is really put yourself in a situation where all of your priorities are put in perspective and suddenly you'll have an insight as to who you really are. And I kind of, my notes on this, you know, kind of go in order through the movie, and I know we've been kind of bouncing around back and forth all over the place. I did want to point out that another theme here is the idea of the real entities, real people, real individuals, versus artificial entities, versus the, you know, the corporate machine, basically, that the narrator finds himself working in, that defines his life, that tells him where to go and where to be. The consumer, you know, machine that's, you know, that's telling him what he should have and what he, you know, what he needs. And you can expand that into government and everything else. These artificial entities that we've created in our society and how they've reduced the real entities, the individual people, down to just cogs in the overall process. That's another running theme I think I see here in this film, especially as we get into the Project Mayhem aspect of the film.
Right. I think it's indicated as early as his first run-in with his boss, where he's discussing his yellow tie, and that meant it must be Thursday, and just the cue from seeing that yellow tie, it lets him know what exactly his boss is going to say to him, and he actually says it to his boss before his boss says it to him.
Right, and the lingo they're using, the corporate speak that they choose to use, also, you know, it screams volumes, basically, about just what the situation is. This is, that's not a natural way of speaking, but this is how they communicate, and it's what is acceptable as far as their dialogue back and forth. Any other form of communication probably wouldn't have been acceptable. So yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's put right at the beginning of the movie. You get this idea that here you are, here he is. He's just the average guy. He's doing the average job or whatever. And you're let know, it's known right off the bat that this is not the ideal. That this guy is not living life as life is meant to be lived, according to the author. The next thing I wanted to mention, again, I'm going through this thing kind of you know, step by step through the film. We get to the point where the narrator, Jack, he goes to this meetup group for testicular cancer, and he meets Robert Paulson, played by Meatloaf. And Robert Paulson has his body is up to his estrogen to counteract the amount of testosterone he got in his system after he had his testicles removed. And he has these huge tits. They call them bitch tits. And the idea that they're huge the way you would expect God's tits to be. So one of the things I learned from Fight Club is that, you know, God has huge tits.
Right on. Yeah. That's pretty good right there, man.
Now,
go ahead, man.
Back to the possession thing. He talked about the IKEA nesting instinct. That, you know, we kind of already covered this ground, but the quote from the movie would be, "What kind of dining set defines me as a person?" And, you know, how much stuff, I mean, and we've talked about this in other shows and everything else. How much stuff do we have? How much stuff do we own that we have this thing, not because it serves us, it serves some sort of function or whatever, but it's something that defines who we are. I mean, here I am, I'm auctioning off a bunch of crap that I've collected over the years, bric-a-brac, that, you know, and these were things that, oh, that's, I'm going to get that because that's totally me. You know, what the hell am I going to do with a Beanie Baby? But, you know, sure as shit, I saw that Grim Reaper Beanie Baby, and I wasn't thinking about its collectability. I wasn't thinking about how, oh, this will be nice to cuddle up with in my sleep. I'm going to go ahead. I just said, oh, that's, you know, that's some little thing that I'm going to put on my desk or put on, you know, put in my tattoo studio. Now, when people see it, they'll have a greater sense of who I am. And it's a signal that I'm probably trying to put out to other people. You know, instead of just doing my thing, just being who I am, I'd rather have this set of symbols around me that tell you who I am without me having to do anything. And it could become contrived. It could become more about, you know, who you want people to think you are and how you want to be defined rather than who you actually are and how you actually define yourself.
Right. I mean, those are actually tools of personality development. I mean, at least as far as I see them. I think one of the neatest things about the whole the movie is this, the idea of the fight itself, that the man that you are in Fight Club is not the man that you are outside of Fight Club, that this is this is a time when, you know, you've got to put up or shut up. This is win or lose. You're going to give it your all, and you're still going to adhere to this sense of honor, you know, these eight rules. And I'm sure that you've got something on the rules, so we'll kind of save the rest of that there, but I just want to kind of plug that in.
Well, I guess I also wanted to point, yeah, it's, again, talking about the same thing we've kind of been railing on here, is that when these people go into the fight club, when these people are actually in the fight, doing what they want to do, they're expressing and living based on, again, their own actions, their own behaviors. They're defining themselves through their effort, whatever that happens to be, rather than through their job, through whatever socially acceptable, through having the proper clothes and that kind of thing. It's raw. It's, you know, it's an emotional thing, and you're defined only by, you know, what's your skill level in putting into man-to-man combat. So I also point, there was something in the movie, if you're watching, at some point, actually it's when the narrator has been in Fight Club already. So he's been in, he's leaving Marla's, and Robert Paulson runs into him again. And this is the first time that Robert Paulson's before Project Mayhem. Robert has seen Cornelius, is what he calls him, sees Cornelius for the first time since the group thing. On the wall behind them is some graffiti. The graffiti, and it's repeated four times. It's one phrase on top of the other, but it's the same phrase. It says, "I like myself," over and over again. "I like myself. I like myself. I like myself." I wondered if that was like a hidden thing that they, you know, because when they do these sets and everything else, they know what's going on. They have some intention going on with, you know, what's going to be seen in the screen. All that's planned out, as far as I know. And I'm wondering, you know, if that's something that, you know, they wanted to underscore. The idea that, you know, do you like yourself? Do you really, you know, do you know who yourself is? Do you know what that is and what that means? The idea of you.
Right. Well, I mean, it's just basically, you know, from what I definitely believe it's intentional. And it seems to indicate that what we do is feed ourselves platitudes. And day in and day out, we feed ourselves platitudes to cope with the fact that we're directly dependent upon this larger organism that has really no, it has very little to no concern about what's beneficial for our own growth as an individual.
Right. Another point in the film where the same idea is reiterated, where the narrator, Jack, decides to confront Marla during one of the cancer group discussions. As the group leader is walking around, the guided meditation person is walking around, he approaches Jack and Marla and says, "Share yourself completely." Well, if Jack, the narrator, the average man, the everyman, does not know who they are, does not know what that self is, how can they ever hope to share themselves completely? And that's some place I think we all find ourselves, is that when we're talking about, you know, even, you know, you've got a person you're married to, you got a wife or whatever, are you capable of actually sharing yourself completely with anyone, especially if you're not aware of who that person is?
This is why I think the concept of hitting rock bottom was so heavily reiterated and emphasized throughout the whole movie. This crashing down, this disconnection from the perceptual self versus the essence of self. Because this, you know, for anybody who practices any form of esoteric thing, this is how you actually get to understanding who you are, by long periods of introspection.
Right, right. And one of the first, and this is something that is talked about in the fourth wave, something that eventually happens, as you go through that introspective process, you're paring down, you're cutting away many of the things that are superfluous, many of the things that are unnecessary. And this is one of the points they make right at the beginning of the movie, that one of the first things you have to do is let things go. And Jack's power animal, the penguin, when he does the guided meditation and the cancer group, tells him to slide. That there are some things that just they are not worth your time. They are not worth pursuing. And that you need to let those things go. Marla lives by this idea, and this is how Marla ends up becoming Jack's power animal later in the movie, basically, when he has the same sort of meditative process, that Marla's there telling him to slide. And he mentions how Tyler has the ability to really just let the truly important things slide. So again, another theme that's running throughout the movie, and I know that one of the people in the chat room actually put it out there, you know, losing all hope is freedom. This is something that Jack comes to conclude when he goes to these group things, that if you, when you lose all hope, when there's nothing left to hope for, well then, whatever comes, that's what you've got, and that's what you deal with. So there are no expectations, and it's a sense of freedom. Tyler later says something along the lines of, if it's only when you've lost everything that you're capable of doing anything. And again, along the same idea, the fourth way, getting down to that, you know, that null state where you are, you know, you're not anything but a blank slate, basically. You're nothing but your core essential being. And then from that perspective, can you actually begin to recognize what it is you're capable of, what it is that you really want to do and want to be, and maybe even develop some sort of satisfaction with your life?
Right on. It seems like usually people, when they reach those desperate points, this is, you know, the time that you find out the stuff you're really made out of. And once you know what you're really made out of, it becomes more easy to determine what it is you want to do. I mean, obviously, if you're, you know, a car, you don't want to go into the water.
Right. And this idea is underscored again, the issue we have with our identity, the issue we have with not, you know, being who we are in a consistent way. And you want, because you, like you're saying, if you don't have that idea, if you don't have a firm grasp of who you are and what it is you're capable of, what it is you want to do, if you haven't really had that kind of introspective exploration, well, then you don't know what you're capable of. You'd be like that car that ends up going underwater. In the movie, the narrator, when Jack goes to these different groups, he always has a different name. You know, Rufus, Cornelius. It's always somebody different. It's always something else. It's never consistent. Again, like I said, just underscoring this idea of identity being an issue, because we're not who we're told we are, and we're not given the opportunity to figure out who we are for ourselves and our society. It's not considered acceptable to do so.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, if you stretch outside of certain bounds, you can end up in jail very quickly. So,
Right.
There's these constant parameters to reinforce the fact that, you know, that they need this consumer animal.
Right. Yeah. And if you stop being that consumer, I mean, that's, they don't need producers. They need consumers. You know, producers help and everything else, but production here in our society is just a means for you to be a better consumer. It's not actually, because if you could just produce the things you needed, well, then there'd be no need for you to consume from elsewhere. You'd just be able to, you know, work the land or whatever it is you would do and have the things you need. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the things that I think is interesting that is also kind of put in there is that consumerism or experience or consumption of any sort, which I would call experience, can be addictive. And that's something that's put in there. I mean, that's why he's going to these groups. That's why he's defining himself by his dining room furniture. That's ultimately why he's, enjoying a single serving life.
Right. And it's, what he's going for, these values that have been instilled in him, this need to buy the right dining table, to buy the right set of comforters or whatever, they hit on it briefly, actually, in the movie, but then it's they hit on the actual, they hit the point on the head, and then they kind of dance around it throughout the film. At the beginning of the movie, as he goes through what's going on, you know, his insomnia, going to these different groups and everything else, he comes around to the point that this whole thing started, or this whole thing was over a woman, Marla Singer, okay? And the thing I took from that was that in our society, one of the things, one of the levers used to get us to become or to seek out these, you know, superfluous values, these things that we don't need, is the standards that have been established for each gender as far as our roles are concerned. Okay, that's it's only desirable, it's only worthwhile to have a particular kind of woman or man or mate or what have you. That you have that these standards, the standards that you're looking for in a mate, is not what you define them as. It's not what you're looking for. It's, you know, you're looking for the chick with the rock and rack and the one that you're the whatever, or the dude with, you know, the amazing pecs and, you know, the nice job or what have you. The whole personality thing, and I know this isn't necessarily the standard that everybody lives by, but it's definitely the one that's pushed by our society. If you watch our advertising and everything else, that personality and, you know, humor and all those other things are really a second place compared to the superficial stuff that makes us want to have the right things to make up for our inadequacies.
Jay, let's go ahead and we're going to go ahead and pull Zach on the line. He's ready to say something, so.
All right. You want me to do it?
Oh,
he just went away.
Just went away. Damn. He had sent me a text message a few minutes ago, and I just realized his number was sitting there. He probably got tired of listening to us ramble, but there's just a lot of stuff going on in this movie. I mean, we're kind of moving at it. Oh, there he is. He's back on. I'll get him.
Zach, you're on the ooze, man. What's going on?
Hey, gentlemen, how you doing?
Good. How are you,
good,
man?
Good. You know, I wasn't planning on calling in tonight, but I had to pull over from work here to touch upon this because, well, one, Fight Club is one of my top five favorite movies. And, Jason, you left when I got cut off. You were talking about its focus on anti-materialism. And, you know, it's weird because I had kind of a personal experience with that. We actually, like, we don't really need all this bullshit. Like, we're raised in a society that tells you, you know, to be successful, to be, and this is where the real shitty thing is to be happy. To be happy in life, you need the best car. You need that Porsche. You need this, you know, $2 million house. You need his wife with this extravagant face, and she obviously needs a $50,000 gem on her finger. You know, this is our way to happiness. And I really like in the movie where when Edward Norton, you know, loses all of his bullshit. He loses all of it, right? And he was living the life that he was taught he was supposed to live. And then when he got there, it was like he was more miserable than he'd ever been in his life, and he couldn't figure out fucking why. And it took him to lose everything in order to come back to what was real and what was real in life. And, you know, I had kind of a personal experience with this personally where it kind of touched home with me, and it did at the time because the movie came out before I had this experience. And I didn't associate the two until, you know, almost a few years ago. But when I was in my early 20s, I bought into a pizza restaurant, and we ended up turning it around, and I went from making, I don't know, $15,000 a year, so about $70,000 within like a year or maybe two. And what did I do? You know, I was very materialistic. I thought, oh, okay, I finally achieved success. Here we go. I bought a brand new car. You know, I bought a nice apartment. You know, my taste in women just went up. You know, instead of having one girlfriend, I had four, and they all had expensive taste. And, you know, but then I realized, fuck, man, I'm working 70 hours a week. I'm fucking miserable. I got all this shit that I have that I'm supposed to make me happy, and here I am. Can you guys still hear me, by the way?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I'm sorry. My phone beeped like it dropped. I just want to make sure I wasn't sitting here talking to myself, because I do that all the time. But no, and then I came through a bad point in my life where I fucked up, and it was totally my fault. But I ended up losing everything within a matter of years, and I put myself in about $30,000 worth of debt. And I was so fucking stressed out, man, because I thought my life was just falling to pieces, and I thought my life was just meaningless now. And I ended up being homeless for 4 months. But that is what got me to really sit there, you know, when I had no job, I had nowhere to go, I had nothing but time, you know, and the only thing I was focused on was survival. Where am I going to sleep? Where am I going to eat? Those are the only two things I cared about. You know, occasionally where I was going to shower. But after a few months, and after, you know, I got sober, relatively sober, it dawned on me, you know what? You know, I only need this basic minimum shit, and I'm just so much happier now. Now that everything that I care about fits in a fucking suitcase, and I can just bounce. Fuck all these bills. Fuck all these debts. Fuck all this shit, man. You know, I at a moment's notice, dude, I can just get on a plane with one suitcase and leave. Fuck all this IKEA furniture. Fuck this new car. Fuck the credit cards. Fuck the people that I owe money to, you know, the corporate monglers and shit. And, you know, it's sad that it takes that for a lot of people, because I was raised in the materialistic society, especially here in America, where that's the goal. You know, you go to college, you get your fucking degree, you get out, and you battle up your way into the, you know, corporate ladder until you can afford that shit. But you really don't need to. But in a way, you do, because everybody thinks that you do, and everybody says you do, and it's a merit symbol. It's a merit badge. And once you pull your head out of your ass, like, you know, everybody needs to, then you realize that you really don't. And I'll tell you what, man, although I'm as poor as I've ever been in my life, I'm a lot happier now than I was when I was making that much money. Because now I don't have nearly the amount of stress, and I can just do whatever the fuck I want whenever I want. And I like it that way.
I'm trying to...
Okay.
Oh, I was just saying, in the movie, Marla tells Jack about this new group that she found that was so incredibly awesome, and it was debtors something or another, but I think that was directly related to this whole thing that we're talking about too, because again, Marla is actually living what Jack ideally wants to get to.
Right, and the debtor thing was, it was money, that these people with health issues or dying and everything else weren't as bad emotionally as these folks are having their issues with money. And it's exactly what Zach's saying. It took having to struggle without all of that, being stripped of everything, to actually redefine your own values, figure out what's actually important. And now you're in a situation where even at a rudimentary level, as far as, you know, your lifestyle and everything, I know that you don't live that way. I know that you go do what you want to do when you want to go do it. You're not tied down to the stuff you have. There are other cultures where the idea, or one of the ideals of that culture, is to have that bag of stuff, whatever it is, that suitcase or whatever, that one suitcase that you need, that if the shit hits the fan, you grab that suitcase. You don't even have to pack it because it's already packed. You grab that suitcase and you haul ass. That's part of your cultural identity in some cultures. Now, with us, you know, especially if you're really invested in a lot of stuff, you'll spend, you know, you'll get burned down with the house. You'll die in the house fire trying to figure out what it is you need to pull out and take with you.
Right. And that's really a sad thing when you stop and you think about it, man.
There's a scene in the movie where Chloe, she's the cancer patient. She's the chick who's almost a skeleton, basically. She goes up to speak. You know, she says she's finally made her peace with death. That she has no fear of dying at this point. Now all she wants to do is get laid. That she scaled her life down to what's truly important. Just that human contact. Just that, you know, being with somebody and having some sort of physical outlet. And that's all she was interested in or cared about at that point, because dying meant nothing else mattered.
Right. Right on. I mean, and when it comes down to it, as a species, that's like one of the four things that we actually really need.
Right on.
You know, well, isn't it? It's air, it's food, it's shelter, and it's sex, and that's really all we need.
Right. And Marla tends to be the character, like you said, that lives that way. You know, she walks into a laundromat, snatches clothes out of a dryer. They're not her clothes, you know, and she takes them immediately over to some, you know, clothery or whatever, and turns around and sells them for whatever she can get. When she walks across the street, she doesn't care what the cars are doing. She just walks, and walks calmly. She's oblivious to the cars that are around her. She smokes constantly, smoking in a group meeting where everybody has cancer, where you're in a lung cancer, you know, recovery group, and you're smoking a cigarette. Marla is oblivious to consequence, to all that, because she's lived that philosophy. She'd be dead in any minute. So given enough time, none of it matters.
Right, and she's she stops, she turns around and talks to Jack right in the middle of traffic. I mean, as a matter of fact, that's right as she's leaving the laundromat. I thought that part alone spoke just miles about the actual character.
Right. Right. And it's you know, it's not until, and it's funny because it's not until Marla actually begins to develop a relationship with Tyler, with Jack, that she kind of loses that edge, that it actually, there's actually something to be concerned about. But again, it's a matter of, you know, what's important for Marla. It isn't the material things. It isn't the nice place. It isn't, you know, whatever. It's just having that connection, having that other person that she can turn to or she can go to and be accepted for who she is.
Right. Well, what I think's actually interesting is the shift that Jack's character takes towards the end of the movie, where as what I would interpret as some kind of an act to show that he's not scared of life anymore. He just steps out in front of that bus and puts his arms out, and then he goes through that whole monologue about, you know, just take this money, get on that bus, and if you never want to see me again, that's fine. But it isn't up until that point that you see him really, as that character, take any risk at all.
Right, right. That, you know, that's that point that he's actually beginning to, it's all beginning to gel for him, basically. That it's the things that he considered important, he hasn't even had them for months. You know, all the things that mattered to him before, they're no longer a part of his life. So it's an easy thing for him to do, to stand there in traffic, tell that guy honking at him to just shut up and to focus on what is important for him, which at that time was Marla's safety.
Right. And that, I think, is another really cool little underscored message that's there. You know, up until that point throughout the whole movie, he had been treating this girl like total shit. At the same point, you know, he's having all these wild dreams and shit and can't really quite figure out what the hell's happening with it. You know, and when he's confronted with what it is that he's actually dreaming about or really wants, he gets hostile about it.
Right, right. Well, he's so out of touch with who he is that when Marla first walks into one of his group meetings and he sees her, he doesn't recognize the immediate attraction he has to the woman, and he becomes hostile because he doesn't know what to do with it. He doesn't know what it is.
Yeah, my kid brother is actually kind of the same way. If he's approached by a girl, and say she's a server in a restaurant, and she pays a little extra attention to him, you know, trying to find out about him, he immediately thinks for some reason that she's going to spit in his food or that she's making fun of him. And so his initial reaction is to be the biggest jackass he can to her.
Right, right. It comes from, again, it falls back to what are our social values? What are our ways of, you know, what do we consider important or the ideal or what have you, and how much of it's artificial, how much of it's programmed? We don't know how to communicate with one another anymore. We don't know how to express ourselves with one another anymore. We don't recognize the natural cues that were in place before. So what ends up happening is you either go your brother's route, where anybody that's friendly to you, anybody that smiles at you, anybody that waves, well, they're trying to fuck with you. Or you go the other route, and I know a lot of douchebags like this, who if a chick waves at them, and you see this with women, especially, women are actually programmed to, if you walk by a woman and make eye contact with a woman, okay, her response is often to smile, okay? Whether she recognizes you or not, she acknowledges you looking at her by smiling. And this actually got my girlfriend in trouble because we live, you know, in the community we live in, there are lots of men who go out of their way to get your attention, basically, if you're a woman. And if you smile, they consider that as reciprocating whatever antics they use to get your attention, honking their horn, the wolf whistles, the cat calls. They might not even speak English, but they know how to click and whistle and shit to get a woman to look up. And then if a woman smiles as part of the natural response, well, now you've got this guy following you throughout the store and everything because he thinks you were impressed in some way. So she'd actually have to circumvent that behavior, that program behavior in herself to keep from doing that. So you've got these, again, you've got these guys who, again, they don't recognize the body language because they aren't good at communicating with people because we're losing that ability. We're losing that natural language we have when we discuss things face-to-face with one another. And yet everything's out of whack. Nobody understands what everybody else has to say.
Right on. We're actually getting ready to reach the top of the first hour. Well, actually, the top of the second hour. I'm actually very impressed because so far all we've really dealt with is the psychological and esoteric dynamics of this movie. But the movie is so much more robust in terms of it, the categorizations that it's dealing with. I think we could probably spend some time, unless you have something else really to talk about in terms of what's going on with him as a person. There is Project Mayhem still to deal with, and the anonymity of Fight Club itself, the designs of the rules. I mean, there's a ton of things going on here that I think, yeah, we're definitely going to fill this next hour up.
Right, and yeah, we can move on to. I wanted to talk about the rules. I wanted to talk about the different things they were doing to Project Mayhem. So I have the list of projects from the movie, and the homework assignments that were passed out. But yeah, we've really kind of analyzed the characters and the themes and everything else that's going on, and it is so much of it is esoteric. So much as it's a screaming message, basically, to people who watch it, suggesting, you know what, hey, there might be an alternative to what you've got going on. There might be an alternative to the things that you think are important, and you might want to do a little bit of investigating.
Before we get into it, I got one more 12-second clip that I think would probably fit real well right here. So I'm just going to go ahead and roll that real quick.
I see all this potential, and I see it squandered. God damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars.
That's the end of the clip.
And
this, I think, is the major focus of the movie. It goes beyond just the development or the breakdown of your material self. It goes to speak on a level societally of what's really happening, and this is where it ties into what we were actually talking about last night, which what we were discussing last night was people taking an interest in things but never really taking any action. So with all that being said, we'll go ahead and hit your notes, man.
Well, and just to roll into that, there's a point in the movie where Jack's talking to a detective on the phone, and Tyler's telling him what to say, and is encouraging him just to confess. And he says that one of the things he says is, and he says it really fast, you kind of have to be paying attention to catch it, that we reject the basic presumption of civilization, especially the importance of possession. And then the quote you just played was, I've seen in Fight Club the strongest and smartest men who ever lived. I see all this potential squandered. An entire generation pumping gas and waiting tables. Slaves with white collars. Working jobs we have so we can buy shit we don't need. We're the middle children of history. No purpose or place. We have no great war, no great depression. Our war is a spiritual war. Our depression is our lives. We've all been raised by television to believe we can be a millionaire, movie gods, or rock stars. But we won't, and we're slowly learning that fact, and we're very pissed off. And I think that speaks about a lot of the things that we see going on. It might just be, you know, I could sit there and say that maybe it's not the majority of us that see that kind of thing going on, but there's all these different movements out there of people who are fed up. They're fed up with the way things are ran. They're fed up with the way things are being done. And they're actually stepping out and doing something. And they're calling, not only are they doing something, but they're calling to others to take whatever action they can take, whether it's, you know, trying to become more self-sufficient, so that you are less reliant and less empowering to these institutions that are artificial and controlling and what have you, or if actual, you know,
active efforts tearing down those very things. So the Fight Club rules, let me see here, how to make soap, I wrote that down. let's see. The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is that you do not talk about Fight Club. Those two rules say to me that whatever it is you got going on, you want to keep it secret. You want to keep it special. That what you're doing is what's important. You don't want to turn what you're doing into a social status. You don't want to rest on your laurels and be satisfied with just your accomplishments. It's about the experience, not the discussion of that experience.
Absolutely. There's a point in the movie just before that car scene, it was just before that car scene, just before the actual falling out of Jack and Tyler, where Jack says to Tyler, you know, I thought this was about you and me. And he says something to the effect of, don't be naive. This has never been about you and me. This is about what we're doing. It's bigger than us. So we're nobody. We're worth no more than the dirt in the ground.
Right. That's the point that Tyler keeps making. When you get into Project Mayhem, he talks about that a great deal, that you're all part of the same decaying biological matter, that you're all part of the same compost heap. The third rule is when someone yells stop, goes limp, taps out, the fight is over. And I thought this rule was pointing to how when you're around people who are engaged in the same activity, that have a similar understanding to what you have, your brothers and sisters basically, that you treat one another fairly, that you deal with each other honorably. Because these are your people. They are your kin. They are the people who are, you know, in the fight with you. So they deserve your respect. They deserve to be treated well.
Right. And I think it goes even further than that. It's, the discussion of throwing each other under the bus, which is a very common theme nowadays, you know, especially in the workplace. If you work in any kind of commercial industry or corporate industry, there's this constant fear that the guy next to you is just when you're beaten down, just when you're at your weakest and you know you're laying there bleeding out on the floor, that's when the guy's going to take out his little dagger and stab you.
Right. Well, and we see that in our own social circles here on the internet. I think I was just watching a video. I don't know what I was doing, flipping through videos or whatever, but I saw something come up with Zach's name mentioned and Dark Fool's name mentioned, and it was Paul Valentine. And Jason King's name was mentioned and everything else. And it's like, Paul. This is a recent video by Paul Valentine where he's still talking about Jason King, Dark Fool, and Zach Black. And he rambles, like Paul Valentine does. It's incoherent, it's all over the place and everything else. But it's his effort to stay relevant. It's his need to still be somehow part of the conversation that we see going on there. And it's, like you said, throwing those people under the bus. Never mind that, they all share a similar title or a similar perspective and everything, that Paul's trying to get ahead by putting other people down. And you see it, all over the place. And hell, we've engaged in it ourselves. Just to be completely honest, we've done videos and everything else where we were just tearing somebody apart for their ideas. But it's because we disagreed with those ideas. I think we kind of evolved eventually where it wasn't so much calling a person out, it was just calling attention to the behavior. And now we don't even so much even engage in that anymore.
Not very often.
What's that?
Not very often, no.
Yeah, not very often. And now, but there are others out there now who are following the same behavior. And there's a learning curve that needs to go on there. That's exactly what they're doing. I'm going to, instead of doing something, and making my mark through what I accomplish, I'm going to try to make my mark by contrasting myself to somebody else and tearing those people down. And they are just listening, just waiting, just watching for that mistake to be made so they can pounce on it.
It's exactly it. And the thing of it is, if you make everyone your enemy, then you know, you never, you don't have any allies. If everybody's your enemy, you're surrounded.
Right, right. And it's, and it goes more to this whole, the value system that we have in place. I mean, it's, when kids get together in the playground, basically, they play together. I was watching my my six-year-old. She's at the pool. There's these other kids, strange kids or whatever. She goes over, and it's just completely natural for her to engage them in a conversation and to talk and play and do whatever. But she's not looking to compete with them in any way whatsoever. Whereas in our society, you know, we're, there's a certain need for competition, definitely. But when it's, you know, you're always looking for that, that knife to be stabbed in your back, and you're always looking for the opportunity for you to pull out your knife and stab somebody else in the back, there's a problem. And it's, again, that consumer identity that we have, where it's not just enough that you keep up with the Joneses. If you can burn their shit down and kill them so that your shit's the best, well, that's what you go for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think one of the points in the movies where that's actually demonstrated is at the very end, you know, Jack up until that point is so concerned that all of these people are going to get hurt and all of these people are going to die. But the buildings that they were getting ready to take out were intentionally made empty to show that it wasn't a war against your fellow man that was being waged. And this is something I was touching on last night. But the war was against the oppressive system itself.
Right, right. The institution. So it's the idea there that you don't necessarily want people to get hurt because we're all in this together, basically. And the third rule, you know, when somebody else stops, goes limp, taps out, the fight is over. It's the idea that, you know, these are your brothers and sisters again, so you treat each other fairly. The fourth and fifth rules. The fourth rule is only two guys to a fight. The fifth rule is one fight at a time. What I thought that suggested was, Aleister Crowley talked about how you should only have one star, okay? That you should have a point of focus, that you prioritize and focus. And right now, we've got too many things going on in our lives, typically. We've got the job, we've got the family, we've got all these different things going on. And by keeping our priorities scattered, we're more easily led down whatever path people want to lead us down. So that's what I thought that those two rules were getting at, basically, was the idea that you need to make sure that you know what your priorities are and you focus on those things. And not so much, you know, just go having multiple fights going at a time or having more than two people engaged in a fight, you know, figuratively.
Right. And a real quick mention here for you, Jason. If you happen to, if you haven't already, get a chance, you should check out the last post I did on that new site that we've been working on. So I kind of touched on this.
Right on. Right on. Yeah, I know that you posted a whole bunch of stuff on the new website. On the new blog and everything. So I've got a lot of reading I need to catch up on, but I'm definitely looking forward to it. I just reading through the topics I show pop up in my email. You know, it looks like good stuff, so I know I'm going to enjoy reading that. I wanted to kind of segue to this whole idea, because we're talking about these rules. We're kind of talking about it's almost rules for a society, how to treat each other properly. And these are combatants. That's the other thing to keep in mind. These are people fighting each other. At one point in the movie, Tyler's on the plane with Jack and pulls out the little, you know, guide on what to do in case of an emergency. He talked about how these oxygen masks pops out and oxygen gets you high. Well, that's one of the things that our institutions, our governments, the authority, you know, these different people that are in charge of things, they want to make sure that in an emergency situation, which in many ways, we're engaged in an emergency situation every day in this country, an emergency situation that we remain docile, that we aren't willing to take action for ourselves, that we're willing to just let the government come in and act on our behalf, okay? And that's where they want us to be, instead of taking action and doing things on your own. And that's kind of where another theme in this movie is that, you know, what you can accomplish when you're focused and you step up and start doing things on your own.
Right, absolutely. So that one step at a time rule is definitely, I mean, Hitler himself proved it by trying to fight too many, you know, fights on one on separate fronts rather than focusing his efforts in one direction or the other. So
right, and well, here we are engaged in four or five different theaters of warfare, theaters of combat. I count the southern border here between the Mexico and the United States with these drug cartels and everything else as a fifth theater of combat. You know, we're engaged, you know, here we are with our military engaged in all these different, you know, combat zones, just like we haven't learned anything from history. So the sixth rule is no shirt, no shoes. And I thought with this rule, it's about, again, getting back to basics. No civilization, if you will. These, you know, you take off your shirt, you take off your shoes, you're connected to the earth, and you're about to connect with somebody else. Okay? So that connection is going to be there. Again, it's going to be in combat, but that way your shoes and your shirt are off, those symbols of, you know, status, those things go away, and it's just two guys, you know, having their discourse. It's just two guys duking it out, basically. So the status symbols of civilization are stripped away by that rule.
Right on. Right on.
The seventh rule, fights will go on as long as they have to. You keep acting until you accomplish your goals. And the eighth rule, if this is your first fight, or if this is your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight. Now, we've got a lot of people that talk about ideas. We talk about our opinions. We talk about our philosophy and what it is we've got going on. This eighth rule suggests, in my mind, that until you've actually done something, until you've actually experienced trying to make those ideas manifest, until you've actually gone through the process, you can talk all day long about your ideas. You may be very eloquent in what you have to say, but it's all theory until you show you can do it. It's all theory until you actually step up and take and do the things that these other people are doing. And in this particular group, you're not part of the club until you've actually gone through that initiation, until you've actually gone through that event that is common throughout the whole unit, basically. So that, you know, if you haven't gone through that, you know, all these people, all these different people talking again about their ideas, about what they want to do and everything else, about what they think should or shouldn't be done, well, until, you know, you've actually done something, your opinion isn't worth very much.
Right on. And then I guess that, you know, merit stands on its own two legs. That's, you know, that's what that is.
Right, exactly, exactly. It's, yeah, it's, and there's, that's one of the things we've got going on right now that we're seeing every day too, on, you know, especially on the internet and these different communities and everything, is it's a lot of talk. It's a lot of discussion and not much action. And there are some people who are actually getting around to doing something, which is why I keep mentioning again, Anonymous, the ONA. I've been a big critic of the ONA for a while, but having seen some of their newer videos and seeing what it is they're talking about, while I don't necessarily agree with their methodology and a lot of things they've been doing in the past, I see a point to their message. I see a point to the effort they're trying to pursue.
Yeah, the same goes here. I have never actually been, like, not a fan of the stuff that I've seen coming out of the ONA, and I can understand the value of the things that they talk about. But in particular, this L316 group that has emerged, my Dan Dredd, our co-host here, Mindflux, a guy that I interact with pretty regularly on Sim, you know, they're actually putting out some really good stuff and doing stuff. I'm certain of it, both offline and online. I mean, it doesn't. There's this old thing, you know, where once you've learned how to smell bullshit, it's pretty easy to detect it after that. You know, the old saying goes, you can't con a con man.
Right.
You know, and I can tell that just by the way that they talk about things, that there's a sincerity to what they're actually doing. So.
Right. And it's. The issue I have with the ONA, and I make the comparison between the ONA and Anonymous, okay? The organizations are similar. They're decentralized. anybody can step up basically and say they are acting as ONA or they are acting as anonymous. As a matter of fact, these organizations are structured to allow you to do so. A lot of the materials they put out are available for free to anybody who wants them, that kind of thing. It's only when you sit there and say that you're the leader of the damn thing or you founded the damn thing that you run into a problem. Okay, when you go off that end, that you're saying you're taking over the thing, that's where there's an issue. But if you're saying you're participating along these lines, and you now consider yourself anonymous, or you now consider yourself a member of the ONA, that's all fine and good. The difference between the two organizations is that if you look at anonymous, you can actually point to things that they've accomplished. You can see the things that they're doing. You can see the things that's in the news. You know, you see what it is they've been trying to achieve and the things they're going after and everything else. With the ONA, not so much. And I'm of two minds on this. That either the ONA has never really structured themselves in a way that has done anything of impact to merit the kind of attention that Anonymous has received, or they actually use the decentralization to their benefit, and they make sure they're never a target. That
right.
There are all these activities that are being done, but not necessarily with the ONA named, you know, attached to it, so that they never become a target for retaliation.
Right.
Anonymous has, you know, become a target for retaliation.
Yeah, they're not tagging their work. I mean, this is actually both of them hold the similarity to the way that Fight Club's Operation Mayhem and the other Fight Club franchises, as they're referred to in the movie, develop. And one of the things that I really liked about that whole thing and part of that whole breakdown process was, you know, getting people to realize that their actions didn't need any kind of recognition at the other end of it.
Right, right. And it was the result itself that mattered, not recognition for the results, not acknowledgement as leaders. There's a point in the movie where when they get corporate sponsorship after that goes down, after the homework assignment to go out and pick a fight and lose. Now the leaders are kind of walking in the background. They're in the darkness, while all that matters are the two guys fighting, what's actually being done. That's what's important. So as these different franchises develop, it's the same thing. They all, and later in the movie, Jack, the narrator, tells the cops that, hey, these cells are very independent of one another. You know, they're very capable of taking steps on their own. And that's going to be important, I think. I think that's, especially when you're talking about coming to a point where you may have to combat one way or another an oppressive system, an oppressive centralized authority. It's decentralization that will be of an advantage to you. It's these guerrilla tactics that are important.
I just want to point out that is exactly what I was getting ready to kind of touch on, was that guerrilla tactic, the mentality of those guerrilla tactics. It worked very well for us in the Revolutionary War. They actually used independent Freemason lodges in the same way that Anonymous or the Order of Nine Angles is actually going about things right now, and it's something that I find to be very respectable.
Right. Well, when you mentioned the Revolutionary War, it's one of the things that I thought, it was always a little quirk in history, the British generals complaining about our combat tactics of our fighters, that we fight like Indians, we fight like savages. And what that meant was that our guys had the sense not to stand in a line and, you know, march on these British forces and get mowed down by, you know, by their guns. You know, if we're outgunned, it's just whoever had the largest force would win that kind of fight. There was no strategy, really. So our guys, in many fights, fought like the Indians. We used obstacles. We took cover behind trees and rocks and things like that.
Sure.
Buses are incredibly inaccurate anyways. But having that tactic made up for our lack of numbers.
Right on. I that's actually something Sun Tzu himself employed, at least so the book The Art of War was. But he did it in a completely different way, in that he used the idea of a spy, different types of spies on different levels. Some of them were what might be considered a native spy, and others might be considered, well, I don't know what, double agents, or and then, you know, some might be unknowingly contributing to his tactics as well. And this actually gave his smaller army the advantage against this big army that he was going up against in the Art of War. And for the life of me, I can't remember what the name of these actual clans were, so...
Right on. Well, yeah, it comes back to subterfuge, obfuscation, misdirection, just the, you know, the kind of things that, again, with this, with Fight Club, the idea was not to focus on the individuals, not to focus on the teams that were actually accomplishing whatever it was they're accomplishing, but the things, just the thing they were doing, the result. And
right.
I've got the list of the homework assignments based on what you see in the film.
Right. Before we get into those, though, I just kind of wanted to point out there's a scene in the movie where there's this file cubby hanging on the wall. There's actually multiple ones, and one of them says misinformation. The other one below it says mischief, and then I forget what the other ones say, but they're all employing those tactics.
Right, right. That's all. It's all part of a... propaganda machine, which is one of the things, yeah, it's all, that also is one of the things that they do in the film as part of their homework assignments and Project Mayhem. And it's one of the things we see going on right now on the internet and everything else with these different movements where you put out different information, or you're trying to be mischievous. It's not necessarily breaking the law, but it's seeing how many people you can spoof on something. The homework assignments, they had things like there was a scene where they're tearing down television radio antennas, and in 2011 terms, this would be knocking down the satellite dishes, basically, the dish network kind of stuff. You see those things on apartment buildings and everything else. They were tearing those things down, making sure that, you know, the whole buildings wouldn't have television or good television reception. Erasing DVDs. Having formerly been a manager at Blockbuster, I always thought this was just the coolest fucking thing. They walk in with an industrial, you know, strength electromagnet and basically just wave this electromagnet over all these DVDs, erasing the DVDs as they go by. Let's see here. Changing advertisements, and that's that misinformation thing. You know, applied in a different way. Where they, you know, they've got these different advertisements. Like there's a bumper sticker in the movie that says "Recycle your animals" or "Recycle your pets." So how the hell do you recycle your pet? Or they talk about used motor oil being good for your lawn, that kind of thing. So changing these PSAs, these public ads. Setting off car alarms just because they have car alarms, they make noise and what have you. At one point, they reverse parking spikes. When you drive over the parking spots or whatever, they blow your tires. The corralling of the pigeons was classic, where they corral the pigeons onto a roof and they're feeding them and everything else, and then it's right by a car dealership. So when the pigeons take off, they shit all over these cars. Changing the airline flyers so that the airline flyers show more—it's more realistic about what will actually go down during an emergency situation. At one point, there's a news report that is hung on the wall about the cops confiscating an excrement catapult. There's one about a performance artist being molested. Power outage at an entire mall. A fountain being befouled, so taking a shit in a public fountain, I guess. Kidnapping and shaving monkeys from a zoo. Blowing up display windows, those windows you see at the high-priced malls and everything else, blowing up the displays. Destroying corporate art and the trashing a franchise coffee house. The trashing a franchise coffee house is one of those things that a teenager actually attempted to do as inspired by this movie. He tried to blow up a Starbucks or something.
Right. Right.
So those were all the homework assignments that are actually mentioned in one way or another in the film.
Right. My favorite, of course, was the starting a fight and losing. It gave them an incredible amount of leverage with all of these different entities. Like that same car lot that the that the bird shit all over, I believe, was the car lot that the one guy was picking a fight in.
Right, right. The guy, yeah, he threw the dude on a, he threw one of the dudes on top of a car and everything. The other, the big one, the big homework assignment was the human sacrifice assignment. And this is one that Tyler apparently did most often on his own, because by towards the end of the film, you see he's collected a number of different driver's licenses. And this is where he goes into a convenience store, pulls the clerk out behind the convenience store, pulls a gun out, and he's got the clerk on his knees. He's got the gun up to the back of his head, and he's asking the guy about himself. You know, what is it that you wanted to do? He goes through his wallet, and he finds an expired community college card. And this guy, he was going to college and everything else, but he wasn't able to complete the courses. They were too hard. He didn't have time to study, so he quit going to college. And Tyler asks him, what would you rather do? Would you rather be a vet, or would you rather be dead? He tells him, basically, you have 6 weeks to get back in college. If you're not back in college in 6 weeks, I'm going to come and kill you. You're going to die. And I'm keeping your driver's license, so I know where you're at.
Right. I know who you are. I know where you're at. Yeah.
Right. And then when the narrator is freaking out, you know, Tyler points out to him that tomorrow will be the best day of that man's life because he came this close to dying. That
right.
Whatever he has for breakfast will be the greatest meal he's ever had.
Right. He even points out that the meal will be better than anything that him or Jack would ever had.
Right. Right. And then the narrator kind of figures it out that Tyler has no fear, no distractions, the ability to let that which truly does not matter slide.
Right on.
And then I think this is the point in the film where they actually get into Tyler's philosophy, that you're not your job. You're not how much money you have in your bank. You are not the car you drive. You're not the contents of your wallet. You're not your fucking khakis. You are the all-singing, all-dancing crap of the world. And this leads into Project Mayhem as one of the mantras they use in Project Mayhem, part of their training. That they're all, you know, they're not a beautiful or unique snowflake, that they're the same decaying organic matter as anything else, that we're all the singing, dancing crap of the world, and we are all a part of the same compost heap. And this is a mantra that they repeat to themselves to remind themselves that if there's nothing necessarily special about them that's inherent. It's all about what it is they do that is worthwhile. That's where the meaning comes in. That's where value comes in. It is, what is it that you do? What is it you're doing that helps you evolve?
Right. And of course, you know, our naysayers would point out that we're, what's the word that was used? We're, I can't think of what the word is, but basically we're telling people what to do.
We're telling people what to do?
Yeah, a while back, you remember you released that YouTube video, bring something to the table?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, where it's, yeah, it's not telling people to do anything. If you don't want to do shit, I know what you're talking about. I can't think of the word itself either, but yeah, it's the idea that this is not the movement that we're seeing in our society, on the internet, in different places. I mean, you can talk about, there's all kinds of different movements going on. The movements, though, have a commonality in that they're telling people, or they're encouraging people to take action, to do something. That inaction is not working. That being docile, the being led by whatever's going on, the going with whatever, you know, current you find yourself in, is not the ideal. It's not going to be the way to succeed or improve your life or improve the situation. That the things that you find that are wrong, you're not going to accomplish by just sitting back and not doing anything. We definitely want to avoid the sense that we're telling people what to do, or with these things that they were talking about in Project Mayhem. These people basically they agreed. They made the choice to subvert that false identity, to subvert that false personality, and instead be focused on accomplishing whatever the agenda was.
Right, right. And I think through this that they're actually learning to solidify their essence, or what's the word for thickening it up? Because that's more what I mean.
Right on. And on the top of my head, I can't think of the word either. But the things that they got going on, the things that would be, these go against the social ideals. That these guys come together, they end up living in this building together, okay, this communal situation. At one point, they've got a garden out the back of this, you know, this house, this industrial center or what have you. They've got a garden they've got out back. They're growing their own food. They're producing soap, so they, you know, they're generating their own, you know, money or what have you. And they don't need the money because they've got their two pairs of black pants. They got their two black T-shirts. They got their black jacket. They got their two pairs of black socks. They got their boots, and they got the $300 worth of personal burial money. That's all they need. Everything else they can provide for, you know, basically just through their own effort.
Right. Right. I mean, actually, that whole house situation, there's a quote in the movie, and I'm trying to remember exactly how it goes, where he talks about the house becoming its own living, breathing organism. It speaks directly to something that I myself have been really on for a couple of years now, and that is the idea of this social organism.
Right, right. That it's the idea, and it's the opposite of the idea that we are all. I mean, I'm big on individualism. Okay, it's a big part of my way of thinking, but it's also recognition that the individualism I'm talking about is independent of all these identifiers, all these things that say you are this or you are that. We're all still part of one organism, this social organism. And it's either we're an active part of that organism or we're not an active part of that organism. We're a docile part of that organism. If you're a docile part of that organism, then you're being led about by the active part of that organism, whatever it happens to be. And
Right. Where
we're at now, that active part of the organism tends to act in a manner that is not to the benefit to the rest of us. It's not helpful. That we don't take action. It's not helpful for us, for our own purposes, what we got going on in society, what we got going on in these different institutions, what we got going on in the government. These things are not designed to benefit us anymore. They're designed to self-perpetuate and benefit themselves.
Right. Well, what so, it is there's no conscious mind. And a conscious mind, as far as I can figure it, is one that's aware of its self in its entirety. You know, when you think about yourself as a body, if you had no idea what was going on with your feet, how could you walk? You know,
if you
had no idea what was going on with your hands, how could you draw? If you had no idea what was going on with your lungs, how could you breathe? But, you know, it's the development of every part being conscious of what it does that creates this consciousness within the social organism that makes it a living, breathing organism, the way that the Paper Street soap factory is.
Right, and the social organism as it is now in reality has a head that is not only unconcerned with what the body is doing, what's going on, but only is concerned about what the body does as long as it fits within a certain set of parameters. As long as the body, you know, docilely, subserviently goes with whatever the head wants to accomplish, well, then the natural function of the body no longer matters to the head. The natural function of that body, of the social organism, is not important to the head. As a matter of fact, it goes against what this head wants to accomplish. So there's this huge disconnection between the head, the authority, or what have you, and the body that supports it. So again, these movements are talking about returning to some sort of connectivity between the governed and the government, where, you know, it's more of a fluid exchange. The governed are participant in the government and actually have a say again in what's going on, and actually will make something happen. If they don't like it, well, then we have Project Mayhem to turn to.
Right, right. And that's inevitably what I see coming, man. We're inside of a decade, I think, from seeing one of the biggest revolutions that has ever happened on planet Earth, and it's going to be a bloody fucking battle. It's unfortunate, but you can just smell the blood in the air when you're outside.
Right, and what's going to be ugly in that it's not going to be a matter of, at least the way I see it, it's not going to be a matter of an institution cracking down on the people. Now, for the most part, what's going to happen is you're going to have a group of people that will turn their backs on everything, that they will just walk away from it all. And when they do, there'll be a group of people that didn't get away fast enough, and then you'll have a group of people that were so dependent on the system that no longer functions, that when the system fails them, they're going to go nuts.
Right.
And they're just going to start tearing everything apart.
And we touched on this last night, so I just want to kind of put that in there. Anybody who's listening to this show, you definitely want to listen to last night, too. This is, oddly enough, worked out to be kind of a part two, so.
Well, it's a theme that we're seeing repeated over and over and over again, and it's going to come from, you know, our particular circles. It's going to come from our end of the spectrum, basically, where this idea that, you know, if it would be to your benefit to do whatever it is you need to do, as you see with Anonymous, where they talk about in their videos, whatever you do, whatever little thing you can do will help. But what you're going for is you want to be, first of all, as self-sufficient as possible. And part of what we have here with Fight Club, talking about how to accomplish that, well, first of all, you have to know who you are. And the quickest route the Fight Club suggests is being able to let go of everything. Go, you know, scrap it all. Go to zero, basically. Even if it's just, you know, in whatever little way you can, you know, keeping your job, the fourth way kind of way, you know, keeping your job, keeping all that, being engaged in society on that level, but getting to zero in your head to recognize that none of the stuff you have, none of this false personality that you're engaged in is important at all. And once you get to zero, once you stop hoping that the government's going to step in and provide for you, once you stop hoping that your job is going to be there, once you start actually taking action to make sure that whatever it is you need is provided for through your own effort, that you have the means to provide for yourself without corporate intervention, without government intervention, that's when you can actually start having not only control of what you got going on, but an impact on the lives of the people around you.
Absolutely, man. And unfortunately, even some of the brightest people, even in our circles, don't figure that out until it's just a couple seconds too late. It's like a game of chess, man. If you fall one move behind, you know, a lot of chess players will just kick their piece over because the chances of your opponent fucking up like you just did are slim to none.
Right, right. So, yeah, and I guess, and the steps, you know, preparing, doing, if you look at the way we live in our society now, a lot of the things that we pay for, you know, whether it's shelter, food, water, what have you, this is stuff that should be available for free. It should be stuff that anybody could reach out, should be able to reach out and take. You know, there's food that grows all around us. A shelter should just be a matter of you putting together something for yourself. And if you can build it, then that should be where you live. And that's not what's happening. You have to have this particular type of shelter. You have to have these particular types of food. You have to have this. You have to have these utilities, these kinds of things. And if you don't have those things, you could be arrested for that. You could be arrested, especially if you have kids. You know, you could be found guilty of, you know, child neglect or child abuse. It could be that kind of. We've got that kind of levers for control against us. So, figuring out what's important to you. Whether or not it's something in a survival sense, as Tyler Durden says, you know, this whole idea is to the hunter-gatherer survival sense of self, is it important or not? With that as your basis, just the most rudimentary existence, figuring out what's important and then working to make sure that these corporations, these government entities and everything else don't have the means to force you to fit within whatever parameters they want you to fit in.
Right. I've got kind of a challenge that I want to put out there for people. And again, it's not something that you necessarily need to act on, but more a mental exercise that you should be performing. And that's, get fired or quit your job and try to, make ends meet without any kind of dependence upon that regular income and see what you have at the end of the day.
Right, or just go through the mental exercise of, if you just ignore your income and look around you, do you have the means without that job to provide for your food? Do you have the means to provide for your shelter? Do you have a plan? Where are you going to go? What are you going to do? I actually see it in the future. What we'll be seeing returning is the idea of the homestead. It used to be in this country where if a family had a piece of land, that piece of land was considered that family's land and passed down from generation to generation, that you'd have, two or three generations of people living and working on the same piece of property in different structures or in the same structures or what have you. I see us going back to that. I see us going back to the point where, we have, children staying with their parents, and this is going on now. Children living with their parents until they're well into their, late 20s or even 30s before they actually move out and get on their own. The problem we have now is that more often than not, the parents themselves are renting their property. They don't actually own it, so there's no homestead anymore. So I think that's going to be something that's going to be coming in the future where we get back to that idea of a homestead.
I don't even think that that's something that's too far off in the future. I think it's going to, this time it's going to kind of cross over the bounds. It's not going to be necessarily a blood relation type thing. It's going to be people who share a similar ideological mindset that clan together in this manner.
Right. Well, I could definitely see that too. Groups of people getting, RVs and minivans or whatever, and pooling their resources and staying on the move so they didn't have to deal with, any kind of government bullshit. That's going on now. And there are other cultures where that idea of a homestead, that idea of a family living together for three or four generations, you've got the grandparents, parents, and the kids, all, adults, and all working for the benefit of that particular household, where that's commonplace. It's only in our consumer society, and only the type of product that we've been made by that consumer society, where we're encouraged to, when you're 18, you move out of mom and dad's house and you join the market, so that you can begin consuming and contributing to the overall economy.
Right. Now, real quick to kind of keep it relevant, but touch back on the movie. One of the things that I really noticed going on through there is that the existence of these fight clubs, the independent franchises, only happen in major cities. And that's actually mentioned multiple times throughout the last half of the movie. And the reason for this being, the closer we get to, shall we say, colonization, the more the idea of these clans falls apart, and the more we become dependent upon smaller plots of land and more people are kind of pressed together into them. And I think that's one of the major downfalls that's happened in China, and something they haven't really put together. If I know you've been across the seas, and I don't know how it is in the Europe end, but I know over in China, there's a huge amount of territory there, and literally maybe 20% of it that's truly developed, but it is not only developed, but it's overdeveloped.
Right. Yeah, we tend to crowd in on one another. And when you're looking at Fight Club, where these Fight Clubs only happen at these major cities, there's a lot of reasons for that. There's, first of all, if you live out in a rural area where you're already independent, where you're already doing your own thing, where you have the kind of freedom that, you know, they're talking about accomplishing in this film, well, then if you got some guy coming to you and going, hey, we're going to have this Project Man where we're going to fight for these things, you're going to be like, you know what, I've already got it. Never, you know, count me out. So this kind of thing can only happen in a place where that oppression is blatantly obvious. And that, unfortunately, tends to happen in major cities.
Yeah, that's actually, I think that is the source of it. What the thing of it is that, and we've made this comparison over the years, you and I, talking about it, you know, the wolf pack or the ant colony. You know, humans, they're more communal like a wolf pack than they are like an ant colony. And by us denying our nature and constantly pressing ourselves together the way that we are, it's creating this repression.
Right. Right. It's what's creating this neurosis. There's all kinds of things. And again, it's a system that's skewed against the people. There was a time, I'm sure, and I don't like to buy into the idea of a system being, you know, intentionally created with the purpose of, you know, this fourth sort of identity, this fourth sort of product mentality, this consumer mentality. I don't like the idea of there being that kind there being conspiracy. I prefer to think that it just occurred naturally. That just the process that was engaged at one point was considered the most beneficial process for our society. And now it's just gotten out of hand. It's just become so huge and so bloated that it actually works against itself. But you see in a lot of ways, you see different people who, like with the Department of Education, the founding of the Department of Education, the people that were involved in that process, I want to say Rockefeller might have been one of them, he says in his writing basically that we're not here to actually educate anybody. We're not here to create men of letters. We're here to create a workforce and consumers. And we're here to make sure that we have people who are able to perform the basic functions of an employee. And we don't need anybody that can think for themselves. We don't need any of those, you know, anybody else that comes up with ideas. You know, so let the idea people develop on their own. The social order we're experiencing is skewed against us. And it's movies like Fight Club that are kind of a rallying cry. You know, saying, you know, hey, look, there's alternatives. There's different ways of doing things. There's different ways of looking at things. And if you take action, you can actually have some fun with it. You can actually get out there and do some things that are kind of kooky, kind of entertaining. There's a recent Anonymous video where they basically said, you know, whatever it is you're doing, whether it's becoming more self-sufficient or it's hacktivism or whatever it is you're doing, the one thing that you shouldn't do is get bored. If you get bored, then there's a problem. If you're bored with whatever you got going on around you, if you're bored with whatever it is you're doing, you need to step up and take action right now so that you're not bored, but you're engaged.
Right. Absolutely. Holy cow, man. 2 hours of Fight Club. Awesome.
So, and I tacked on the next episode. We'll actually be talking about next Sunday. We're going to be talking about Anonymous. We'll spend an hour, you know, actually talking about Anonymous. What is it? What do they got going on? What are the different things they've accomplished? Things like that. So we'll kind of get into detail about Anonymous.
Right on. Yeah, I think that's a great topic. I would make the suggestion of listening to yesterday's show because that was, to my surprise, and believe it or not, it was to my surprise. Yesterday was the D-Day for Operation Onslaught, and I wasn't actually aware of it until Sean got me on the air and he started talking about what he was doing. So it's definitely all relative. It's interesting to see, you know, there's something really going on, a real strong undercurrent happening, and it's been happening for a long, long, long time. But when you see art begin to imitate life and take shape in the way that Fight Club did, and the way that George Orwell's 1984 or A Brave New World, I'm trying to think of other spots that this.
V for Vendetta, The Matrix.
I mean, that shows that this is really on people's minds, but we're just afraid to act. And I understand why. I understand that every time we act, the pendulum sways, you know, real hard the opposite direction. And we end up with the opposite set of problems, but it's still a set of problems. And what that really says to me on a personal level is that we keep curing the symptoms and not actually treating whatever the illness is.
Right. Well, I guess going with the pendulum swing analogy, though, too, is that every time this pendulum swings, it loses a little bit of its momentum. So, you know, eventually what's found is some sort of a stable situation where both extremes are satisfied, at least in some way.
On a personal level, I think that we as mankind have to accept that we will always be fighting each other. And
right.
So there's nothing wrong with drawing those lines in the ground. You know, there's nothing wrong with saying I stand on this side and you stand on that side, and if you cross that line, I'm gonna, you know, react. I think that when we start to develop these PC ideas, you know, that you can't say this because you might hurt so-and-so's feelings, you know, you have to keep in mind that when you do that, you're actually repressing yourself.
Right. And one of the biggest things I see going on is the lack of interest in activism. Like you said, people are afraid to act, and it's, you know, afraid of what the results might be, afraid of taking the risk, afraid of bringing themselves into, you know, being the focus of something. But there are other folks, there are other movements out there who are acting, and they might not be acting in your best interest. The Tea Party comes to mind right off the top of my head. I consider myself conservative, at least a fiscal conservative. There's a lot going on with the Tea Party that has me concerned, especially when you're talking about abortion rights, we're talking about gay marriage, we're talking about drug use, things like that. That if the Tea Party were to come away with everything they wanted tomorrow, people like you and I would be very, very oppressed in that kind of environment.
Yeah,
and they're active.
Absolutely, man. I can't argue with you enough. But at the same point, I don't see why they can't live life the way that they want to. It just needs to be on their side of the line.
Right. Well, that's part of the issue, is that they're living life they want the way they want to, for whatever reason. For this particular mentality of people requires that they also convert or force other people to live by their standards.
Right. It's something I actually call the Puritan ideology, and that is you know, this hard, strict, well, just like the traditional Puritans as we understand them historically. You know, there's almost a militant strictness to whatever ideology they have, and that is an unfortunate thing.
Right. It wasn't just a matter of them living the way they do based on their own choices, but that if somebody else made another choice, they couldn't tolerate that choice, being the awareness of that ideal or that behavior was going on someplace else. It's total intolerance. But going back to the idea of activism or inactivism, if there are people who are taking action, just like I said, they're active, if you're docile, well, then whatever current they create, whatever movement, whatever trend they spur, if you're docile, well, you're just going to be carried along with it. So unless you're taking action, even if it's just for yourself, unless you're taking some sort of action, you're going to be carried away. I mean, the idea that if you don't vote, well, you end up voting for the guy that won. It's the same kind of idea.
Right on. And I mean, we're literally 60 seconds out, bro.
I think I'm talked out, man.
Right on. Right on. I hear you. So, anyway, next week on this episode, we're going to go into Anonymous, and who knows what we have in store for you the rest of the way around.
Right on.
Thank you for listening to the Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily represent the opinions held by TC, Zach, Jason, Matt, or any other institution represented by them. If you have been offended by the production of this show, we are sorry, but it's the old expression goes. Tough luck. Special thanks to Dad, Rocky DeRoma, for his contribution to this outro. The Ooze is a Creative Oddity Studios product and is presented by Titanic International Network as its official Blog Talk radio show. Why waste your time with those other guys?